PFT Media.
Charge your Musu up and select your Dynasty Warrior character because we're heading to China to discuss the great romance of the Three Kingdoms on Half True History. And welcome to Half True History, where we take the legends of yesterday and merge them with today to get you interested in the topic, even if most of it isn't exactly accurate. I am your professor for the night, Dan P. And always spinning the wheels of steel on the airwaves, we have, of course, Chris Crespo, our super producer.
What is up, everyone?
And manning the airwaves with me, the Zhou Yu to my Sunsei, Pedro Lima.
But I was hoping you would say your Lucy Liu to your Drew Barrymore.
You know, funny that you mention Lucy Liu. We're actually going to talk about one of her ancestors.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She's descendant?
Most likely. I mean, there's a lot of people with the surname of Liu, but Liu was the surname of the ruling family of the Han Dynasty. So back in the Roman Empire days, essentially. She might have been related to one of those emperors or dukes or nobles. And this is probably the most fabricated war story there is outside of the Trojan War.
Is that one of them funny stats just because technically there's like a billion people in China, so that's why it's like one of the most told stories?
It's one of the most...
Back then, they only had a million.
Fair. That's fair.
It was one of the most fictionalized wars of all time. Like, we still are not exactly sure every detail of what happened at that time, because not only was it back in the year 200s, but it was also... had been redone and romanticized and turned into plays and epic novels before that for centuries. So we're still unclear about what is true and what is legend.
So there's something about this particular war that just makes it ripe for hyperbole and...
Is it Chinese Romeo and Juliet, but a three-way?
It's... like I said, more like a Chinese Trojan War. Like, you have these heroes doing incredible feats, and we're not really sure how true they are to the original guides.
But we know for a fact there's no dragons.
Right. No, for a fact there are no dragons. Not in here. But there is magic that is played into this war chronicle. So, again, there's that kind of interesting thing where it's like, we're not exactly sure what they saw as magic back then, but they're saying this is what happened.
Was the red panda in a unicycle doing the cup trick? And like, oh, she's magical. Look at her. She put all the balls in her forehead.
So it's these legendary wars, and which is why you get so many movies based on it, TV series, video games, anime series, you name it. I think... the most popular one in America is the Dynasty Warriors series, which Koei makes, and the superpowers that they give those heroes in the video games, and if you watch Three Kingdoms, or if you watch even Red Cliff, John Woo's Red Cliff, we have what they're doing is they're actually just following the books about what they said these guys did.
It's like if you're doing a literal translation of like Bible stuff, and then you put it up on screen, you're like, whoa, this stuff looks ridiculous. Yeah, well, it's just, that's what's in the book. That's what they said.
Exactly. It really was. Romance of the Three Kingdoms was the novelization of this historical event. It was written in the 1300s. So you're looking at 1,000 years after this event, then it's romanticized into this epic battle and takes sources from all over, all three regions, and comes up with this story that you have. I mean, you just have men who are battling 200 troops with their bare arms, or great stallions that can ride faster than 10 times faster than the fastest horse. And it's all just this amazing superstition.
Sounds pretty awesome.
Oh, it's great. And it's, I mean, have you seen John Woo's Redcliffe?
That I have not. And I know there's even like a director's cut version as well. That
the director's cut.
Yeah, it didn't come out in America theatrically, but it's like much longer, like 45 minutes longer, something like that.
Yeah, it's like 2.5 hours, 3 hours for the director cut. Definitely see that. It tells the story a lot better.
I'm going to have to check it out. And that was like John Woo going back to China, too. So like, it was a bit of a homecoming movie for him.
Oh, yeah. No, it was great. It basically, just to get off a little off track here, it's the difference is just like seeing the movie version of Kingdom of Heaven and then seeing the Ridley Scott cut of Kingdom of Heaven.
Oh, yeah. That's a huge difference. Yeah.
That's basically what it is in the international version.
All right. Well, yeah, I'll just try to get my hands at director's cut then.
Yeah. So
Redcliffe. Okay.
Redcliffe, yeah.
Yeah, it's from like 10, 12 years ago, maybe?
Yeah.
Yeah.
2008, something like that?
Something
yeah.
Like that. Yeah.
God damn, it's 4 hours and 48 minutes?
Yes, that's that director's cut.
Holy shit, dude. This guy wants me to live through this war in real time?
Just one battle. You can do an entire college course on just the War of the Three Kingdoms and its stories and its history. And you still would probably need another half of the year because it really has just been retold and told so many times.
Well, it's a sequel, Redcliffe 2.
That's the international version. In America, they divided it up into two.
It's John Woo's, too.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the same thing, but in America, they split it up into Redcliffe and Redcliffe 2.
Because it's so long, as you pointed out.
So one is 4 hours and 49 minutes, and then part two is like, all right, let me just give you 2 hours and 22 minutes. Peter Jackson is looking at this and be like, pussy. I do three movies, and you can run the New York City Marathon, and still
the movie will be watching them. Still be fighting Smaug.
I did. I opened my mouth 1 year and I said for my 35th birthday, I want to run the New York City Marathon. And Tom Murphy goes, I'll tell you what, I'll watch all three uncut Lord of the Rings movies back to back to back and you won't be done.
You could have taken that bet.
No, dude,
I know it's running hard, but those movies. Back to back, that's like a time wormhole,
dude. And I was doing research and be like, okay, give me celebrities. What was the worst times on celebrities and stuff like that? Mm-hmm. Like maybe I can run 21 miles in under 12 hours.
Maybe. Yeah. No.
Mm-hmm. Hey, again.
What's interesting about, so just to give you an idea of where this is, this is about the fall of the Han Dynasty during the Yellow Turban Rebellion. So that's how this all starts. The Han Dynasty falls. There's this huge rebellion of the peasant folk, and they all have yellow scarves on their heads to tell each other apart. So it's called the Yellow Scarf or Yellow Turban Rebellion. And their leader, and it starts off magical. Their leader is this religious shaman named Zhang Zhao. And He is known like to have weather magic and call forth tornadoes and earthquakes and things like that on the Emperor's troops.
Nice.
So it starts off already like that. But there's a kernel of truth about that, though. And obviously, you know, not the magic part, or we don't know, but because the time that the Han Dynasty is falling, you're looking at it's the 200s ACE time. And that's the exact same time that the Roman Empire is starting to fall because, and we've talked about this I don't know how many times, the weather change.
Yes. What are we doing? Are we going hot to cold, cold to hot?
We're going to the cold. It's the cooling period.
And in the cooling period, it's the hotter climates that do poorly, right?
The hotter climates do better in the cooling period.
I got it backwards. All right, I knew I was going to get it one way.
So temperate places like China, you're going to see more droughts and famines, and you're going to see, as the Earth is shifting itself and cooling itself off, more things like hurricanes and tornadoes and such. So it all correlates with what this magic shaman is, quote unquote, predicting. He could have just been the world's greatest weatherman at the time.
He just had an almanac.
Yeah. So the emperor is totally unable to defeat him, and he calls all the great warlords together to fight this evil rebellion of the people. You know, they've got to do the right and noble thing of making sure that the rich people stay on top. And that's how it's presented, though. Like, it's how it was written in the 1300s was the glory was always about the Han Dynasty. Even today, China looks at its Han Dynasty, you know, like its Roman Empire, the glorious days, the once great times and everything like that. And so anyone who is helping to restore the Han is seen as a great hero. It's very interesting. And this is where you look at this war from different perspectives, because you can start to see that if you read the tale from a Western perspective, like we have, we're not going to see the same heroes and villains that they see in an Eastern perspective. That's what's the really interesting part on that. So the war, the rebellion ends. And obviously now there's this huge power vacuum. And 16 or so different warlords start fighting each other over who gets to control the emperor to become the next top gun. And eventually it whittles down to three kingdoms. And that's where we get our three kingdoms. Now in the south is the kingdom of Wu. They are under the Sun family. They're related to Sun Tzu.
Sun Tzu, Art of War, Sun Tzu?
Right, that's their ancestor.
That dude, okay.
Very proud, fearsome warriors of the south, very good with navies and very very honorable people. Oh, did I mention the writer of this book is from the south?
Oh yeah?
Yeah.
Like old Tommy South.
Mm-hmm. The good, the honorable ones. And so again, we see it. We will see this as upper class wanting to keep their upper classness. And then the true hero is from the kingdom of Shu, which is the southwest of China. And that is led by a cousin of the Han Emperor, Liu Bei. Liu Bei wants to restore the Han Empire to its former glory. So Wu wants to kind of take over for the Wu family. But Liu Bei wants to really bring the true emperor family line back, his line, of course. But of course, he's seen as this great honorable warrior for wanting to restore history and origins to China. It's very much like how the samurai are depicted in Tom Cruise's Last Samurai. It's just the idea of, oh, look at Tom Cruise, he's helping these noblemen, you know, really embrace their culture and take back their culture. But when you look at it from a real perspective, Tom Cruise was helping the bad guys, the guys who wanted to keep the poor not equal.
But those bad guys were living in the villages.
They respected the peasants, and they wanted to honor the peasants and defend them because they like the idea of the peasants looking up to them as daddy and do everything that daddy tells them to do. They need them to take care of them. So Liu Bei is seen as the hero of this book. Wu are honorable great men. Liu Bei is the hero, the one who wants to really the most noble and kind of all of them. So every great novel, of course, needs a villain. And that's the Kingdom of Wei. Up in the north.
This is not the way.
Right. It's under a horrible, mischievous, demonic, cruel, ambitious tyrant.
Bet you it has a skinny mustache that's long. And the skinny goatee.
The Fu Manchu, yep.
Yep, and it has that boat from It hat.
Yeah, no, you get exactly what you think is going to be the evil Asian bad guy.
So it's the bad guy from Big Trouble in Little China.
Yup. His name is Cao Cao. He's the original devil of China. He is the model of what all Chinese villains will look like from then on.
Oh, she.
And Cao Cao is seen as devious and opportunistic and can't be trusted or anything like that. And when you read the actual histories of Cao Cao, because there's multiple biographies, you know, besides the fantasy book. And it's very interesting seeing him from a Western perspective versus seeing him from an Eastern perspective. In an Eastern perspective, he's seen as the devil for going against Confucianism. Confucianism is all about you are born into your spot. Your job is to do for the Lord will do for you. If you're born as the Lord, you protect the people and the people serve you, but everyone in their station, no one moves up because everyone's a cog in a great machine. And that is your honor. You help the system. And, you know, the social classes don't change. That's the idea of Confucianism, honoring the idea of tradition. So Cao Cao is seen as a villain because he comes from a middle-class family. He's not noble. And he rises high in the ranks of government, becomes eventually the prime minister to the emperor. And he does this thing, which is so vile. He takes land away from nobles and divides it up amongst the people of the Wei Kingdom.
How dare he? How dare he take the nobles' land?
And he starts making his generals in the army and his ministers are all promoted, not because of who their family was, but how good they are. He does this idea called a meritocracy.
What?
Yeah.
Nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
The decline of Asian civilization right there.
Yes, we know it. So yeah, he's seen as evil because he was opportunistic, because he wanted to rise above his station. And they'll make him the most vile creature. And you'll see it when you watch Red Cliff, or you'll see it when any of these Romance of the Three Kingdom parodies, they'll make him this vile creature. And then when you actually do the historical research, Cao Cao favors heavy industry. He really wants the people to rise up, and he wants a huge middle class and industrial class for its time, for, you know, for the year 200. And yeah, like I said, people are promoted based on their abilities, not based on their family. But he's the bad guy.
Do they frame him somehow to make him like a bigger dick?
Oh yeah. The legends are totally just all the, he betrays every person he talks to. He, can't be trusted. There's so many scenes that are just elaborate.
Somebody that was hungry.
Mm-hmm. Red Cliff, they even add this extra element into Red Cliff, saying that he was only invading because he wanted to take the wife of one of the Wu lords.
Huh. Like a King David Bathsheba situation.
Exactly, but it's, you know, and of course that is completely false, because I mean, he did have a primary wife who was a great love. I mean, it's seen
when
in the
poems. When you say a primary wife, that means he had a secondary chick.
He had like seven wives, yes. Okay. In China, Chinese warlords were known for taking multiple wives. Okay. So, but his, you know, his main wife, the first wife, that's the one whose children become his heirs, essentially. You know, that son is the most important son.
The Claire Huxtable of the bunch.
Correct. Right. So, I mean, and the poems that he writes for his first wife and for his other wives, he has so many sons and daughters from them, that the idea of him specifically risking a million men or more in this huge winner-take-all battle just in order to grab this man's bride is just so ridiculous and outlandish to some of the historical recordings that we know of Cao Cao. But it's the version that everybody accepts because it's the myth that has been told the longest.
And it's the one that sells the most books.
Mm-hmm.
It's a sexier story.
Yeah, exactly.
You have your villain.
That legend got printed.
You got the last boss to beat in the video game, yeah.
So it's a good story, but it's not exactly the truths, is what you're saying.
No, I mean, the only thing that's truthful about it is the bones of the war itself. You know, definitely we know the outcome of certain battles. But how they're fought, that is just exaggerated with men leaping over other men by 100 feet and shooting multiple arrows and slicing many men's heads off with axes and stuff. Like, all the great kung fu scenes really are based on some of the elaborations of the War of the Three Kingdoms.
Nice.
Yeah. So it's fantastic. And the best part about this war, what I love the most, is none of them win it. Yeah. They fight so long, all three original rulers die out, and their sons take over, and then their grandsons take over, and the government has gotten so watered down in the Kingdom of Wei that eventually Cao Cao's grandson gets overthrown by the son of his advisor, Sima Yi, and sets up the Jin Dynasty. So it's this huge, epic 80-year war that ends with no one winning.
Nobody winning. Nobody
from the original. Yeah, from the original wars.
And then somebody else just, I'll take it from here.
Right, and he makes this really crappy dynasty, and then that falls into chaos. And you're looking at China just going back and forth in civil wars and chaos for the next 300 years until the Tang Dynasty shows up. So all these guys making this war, this epic, they all wanted to be the person who brought order to chaos. But what they all three of them did, Sun Quan, Cao Cao, and Liu Bei, was basically just put China in a worse state than they left it.
Because they just went around killing each other and then for generations killed each other for no real outcome.
They got so tired. They're like, oh, what are we doing this for? I just want to open a nice Chinese restaurant in America.
can we get this done yet? I want my descendant to star with Drew Barrymore in several action films. And so, yeah, that's the War of the Three Kingdoms. I check out any piece of it, and you'll just see how ridiculous it is. I mean, every single battle.
Red Cliff. Is Red Cliff like the... like the A1 sauce of all the romance movies?
I would say it's the best made, it's the most professionally made. Yeah.
Okay. It's probably the biggest budget one.
Yeah, most of the others are very, you know, 80s, 90s China budget.
Sponsored by Alibaba.
Right. except for the new series, there was a Three Kingdoms series that came out that had a big budget behind it right after Red Cliff. So that's a good one. It's just called Three Kingdoms. So it's really well made also. But yeah, it's all over. You can find it everywhere. It's the most, I would say it's probably one of the most well-read wars in Asia. It's our Trojan War, really. So, there we go. Well, everyone, I hope you enjoyed that.
You've used that Trojan War reference not only on this episode.
Yeah.
But on the Haitian episode, too.
Did we use it on Haiti?
Yeah, so you like it's all like a Trojan kind of thing. So you must have seen a Brad Pitt movie, that movie Trojan.
I've been doing a lot of AP World History stuff lately, connecting classical periods to modern times. So yeah, that might be it.
And it's the one example all the kids know.
Yeah.
So it helps
get right.
Pedro.
Do kids still know that?
Not really. We barely teach ancient history anymore.
Well, who's got time to teach ancient history? You got all this recent history?
Trojan, the first thing they're thinking about is condom.
Mm-hmm.
Like yeah. They, it's weird. They'll know more about the condom than the actual like.
And then you explain it to them. Yeah, well, you're sneaking it in there with that.
And then you take out the condom, and then that's right. How you do the Trojan horse.
Right, the Trojan horse. Yeah, they think is that or a computer virus.
Yeah, why would you name your prophylactic after a thing that's known for like sneaking in something bad that the person doesn't want?
You don't know what's in
there. Well, that's the move.
Yeah,
that's the move. You just put it in once, and then the second stroke, you take it out and put it back in.
It's so bad. You don't even realize
it feels so real. Yes, yeah, it does.
It feels Greek.
Yeah, they build it into their marketing. Oh man, they're in on it this whole time.
Yeah. Oh my god. So hopefully everyone's enjoyed our little sampler of the War of the Three Kingdoms.
Oh, our people platter of the Three Kingdoms.
There we go. That's what I was looking for. So this has been Half True History, and we will see you all in the next page.
Adios.
Peace.
寂寞，独自走向苍茫波，月光带温柔，滔滔不落说，一心要那尽，就有阴谋阳谋，明说暗落的魔。PFT Media Production.